Let's turn on. By that, I mean the power of the mind.
Power of the mind. Power of the mind.
Join your hands behind your head and just think. I give you love in a rainbow. I bring you sparkling sunlight on a green leaf. The golden sun calls you to fashion your way out of the silk which surrounds you.
Okay. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Bookhouse Boys. I'm Matt Howell.
I'm Jason Farrell.
I'm Dave Aloisi.
And we are joined today by a special guest. You know what? I'll edit this out. Do you want me to just use your first name? Some people are super weird about
it.
Okay. Doesn't matter.
I can use your whole name?
It's Emily Craddock. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I can use it, though?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I'm fine with that.
Can we say it every time?
Yeah,
you can only refer to
it full time. Yeah, every time.
Okay, let me start over. I'm sorry. I forgot to ask you before. I was going to ask. Okay. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Bookhouse Boys. I'm Matt Howell.
I'm Jason.
I'm Dave Aloisi.
And we are joined by a special guest, Jason Farrell. Her name is Emily Craddock. She's a member of our Goodreads group, and she's one of our favorite people in the world. Emily, say hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. I'm good. I'm great.
Thank you for
fun.
Yes, thank you for being here. So those of you that go to our Goodreads page know that Emily Emily picked the book, and it was what is it called? In the Heart of the Sea.
I have a hard time every time.
Whaleship Essex.
Yeah.
By Nathaniel Philbrick, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so she picked this. She gave us a list of books that she would like to talk about, and I think we had all read
some of them.
Yeah, most of them.
We've done a couple of them on the show.
Right, we've done a few of them actually on the show.
Never Let Me Go was one of them, which would almost that would have killed Matt and I, but it would have been interesting to revisit.
I'm embarrassed that I don't remember you guys talking about them. I've listened to all your shows, you know. But I don't remember.
You probably remember.
Sad as that.
The sad thing, Emily, is that was back in the old format when we used to discuss the book throughout the entire month.
Yeah.
So
three or four shows.
That may be the last one we did that with.
Still Life with Woodpecker was where I said, guys, we need to talk.
Okay. It was part of that.
We can't keep doing this.
I love you, but it's not working out.
Yeah, the narrator on Lithium. That was good.
Right. So, so Emily, tell us a little bit about yourself, whatever you feel like sharing. We like to know who our guests are as readers or readdresses.
Okay.
Readdresses.
Well, I am, I guess I'm, it's hard to say. I'm a book nerd. I'm fascinated by books, but mostly I really like book podcasts. And I've listened to thousands of book podcasts.
Why? That must
be boring. How many have you been on, though? How many have you been on?
None. This is my first.
That's what I'm saying.
And you guys are my favorite. I feel like you're the closest to me. Like, I know you. But I just love to hear people talk about books and to digest them and pick them apart. And because I feel like I'm not that good at it myself. So I like to hear what other people have to say about it.
Well, when we're done tonight, you'll be an expert.
Okay, I hope so.
That's the Matt Howell guarantee.
Okay. Yeah, you got to teach me how to do this.
Sure. So I know that you are a voracious reader because we are Goodreads friends, and I get updates from you, you know, digested.
Well...
It seems like. Or maybe you're just rating stuff.
Is it a facade? Yeah.
What you're seeing are the ones that I add to my to-read list.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess I'm not looking at it closely.
There's a lot of those.
Yes. That's what it is. Oh. So I add way more to my to read than I actually read. But
I noticed that, but I think you still do read an above average number of books.
You think so?
Yeah. I see quite a few come through there with ratings and
comments
and things like that.
You're not a phony. So can you just give us a quick, like, super concentrated version of, like, kind of your history as readership, you know, readership from, like, childhood through now, like just to
our veins.
Yes.
Absolutely. Well, as a kid, I guess I read normally all the same things that everybody else reads. I remember my first chapter book was the Narnia books.
Yeah.
So I read those. But then through high school, I just was not much of a reader. But the funny thing is after actually went all the way through college, but after I graduated from college, this job where I worked, there was this independent bookstore across the street, and I would go in there every day at lunch and just pick through their books and talk to the owners of this bookshop. And I don't think it was until then that I got into reading and book culture.
Okay.
So, yeah, but as a child, I guess I would say I was just a normal reader.
Okay, so can you give us, like, say, four tent poles that hold up your literary tent of your world? Who are four writers or works that are kind of your go-to when you're describing yourself as a reader?
Let's see. I would, you know what, I would say this book, In the Heart of the Sea. This one got me, well, we could talk about it later.
You describe this as your favorite book. Right.
It absolutely is. Yeah. And I think it was because I actually got this book when I first read it from that bookstore. Mm-hmm. And it was like the first time I was able to grasp, like I was able to pick out on my own irony in a book.
Okay.
And then let's see who else. Now I'm drawing a blank. I do like nonfiction. I have like this weird fascination with Tsarist Russia.
Okay.
So I've read a lot of just books about the fall of the Romanovs and Rasputin.
I'm obsessed with Rasputin as well.
Are you?
Yeah.
He is a pretty fascinating guy.
He has a pretty interesting legend.
Yes.
You know, just, I mean, being unkillable is an interesting legend for a historical figure.
Yeah.
He's almost become like a faux historical figure.
And being like a satanic monk, that's always a fun little paradox.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
And then, let's see, I've gotten into short stories lately. So I'm going to have to jump on the George Saunders bandwagon. I really like him.
Been hearing that name a lot.
Isn't that maybe not George Saunders. I was going to say, wasn't that actually a woman? I think I'm thinking of somebody else.
Oh, yeah, but he just did the 10th of December.
Yes.
This is a contemporary writer.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, very much.
I really want to read some of his stuff.
Oh, I think you would like it. There's some dark humor in there that I don't know.
Sorry, Dave. You won the World Fantasy Award, so you're gonna have to leave off on that one. Yeah.
Dave is a complex individual, and I don't think that it's fair for you to just kind of pigeonhole him like that. You're welcome, Dave. Okay. So.
Well, wait. I may still want to pigeonhole this guy, but we'll
he reserves the right to pigeonhole him.
So you've been getting into short fiction lately, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anything else we need to know about you? Is there any kind Stephanie Myers in your past? Any skeletons in the closet we need to know about?
I figured you guys were going to ask me like what my favorite genre or kind of book is, my favorite kind, and I don't really have anything. Question. I'll take anything that's recommended, but what I can't stand, and this isn't just a snobby thing, is I can't stand YA. And so, like, all the Twilight stuff, I hate it.
Here, here.
Yeah. Oh, I can't stand it. But I'll read just about anything else, believe it or not.
Yeah. Do you think 12-year-old you would have liked Twilight?
Yes, because my favorite books, I'm just going to die. Oh, this is so embarrassing to admit.
Yes.
But I did read back in high school, my favorite books were the V.C. Andrews books.
Oh, my God. Flowers in the Attic and all that?
Yes, I should have mentioned that. I was really into incest.
Yeah, who isn't?
So you read a lot of Penthouse forum letters, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you're out of that phase now is what I'm hearing?
Yes. There's some latent incest in there.
But have you tried the V.C. Andrews book lately? Because, I mean, there's probably some really good ones.
Well, no, I have not. Well, she's dead.
Yeah.
Well, but would her decomposing corpse produce anything really inferior to what she was doing 20 years ago?
Probably not. I remember my mom, back when the Oprah Club was kind of newish, My mom, who reads everything, I mean, she just reads constantly. She always has. But she read all the Oprah book clubs, I think before it was kind of before the stickers on the cover. Like, it was kind of that early. But her early criticism of it was, you know, she said, I don't know what her criteria are for picking these, but I've noticed that in, like, 3 out of 4 of them, there is an impoverished Southern white family and there's inbreeding going on, like incest. Yes.
That's very true.
Like, I don't know what her deal is, or I don't know if that's just a thing with, like, Southern writers or something.
Some kind
but
of complex revenge scenario involved.
Yeah.
So she's that, not, that is a thing with Southern writers, though. Okay. The Faulkner book I just finished had a little bit of that going on.
Faulkner, ooh.
You doing Faulkner without us?
We're doing.
I told you.
No. He's reading the abridged version.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Red Stardust, and then we're gonna read Flags in the Dust in November.
Oh, Flags in the Dust is the full text.
I figure I'll just read Flags in the Dust, and then I'll just cross out every few words, and then read that, and
I'm just getting rid of verbs.
Indiscriminately. Yeah,
just indiscriminately.
Yeah.
This sentence doesn't make any sense anymore.
Sartorous experience.
So do you guys think you have a handle on Emily here, or what?
I like to remain a mystery.
I like that, too.
No, obviously I don't. You see my Twitter account, both of them.
True enough.
Well, I don't know how much of that is voice, you know, and how much of that is you.
Right.
So
that is part of the interest in
it is
the quote unquote real Emily here tonight.
I don't even think I know.
I don't think we're getting real Emily tonight either. I don't think there's any real Emily. I think it's all facets of a complex whole.
I think you just nailed it right there.
With a W. Sorry.
Are you taking a philosophy class? CC?
You know, I'm reading Ishmael right now.
Oh, yeah?
You guys have read Ishmael?
So this didn't inspire Moby Dick, finally. But you're going to read Ishmael before nobody Moby Dick.
Are you guys familiar with this text? It was published in 92 by Daniel Quinn. It's kind of considered the Jonathan Livingston Seagull of the 90s. They made a terrible film. They attempted to make a terrible film out of part of it with Anthony Hopkins. It might have been even called Ishmael, but...
Did he play in Ahab at some point, didn't he? Also,
I don't know, but this is this is all a big conversation. It's modeled after, you know, kind of like the Platonic discourse, like two people talking, and it's a telepathic gorilla talking to a guy who answers a classified ad, and it's all this philosophical kind of pop philosophy, kind of talking about how mankind got in the current state we are. And how we're brainwashed to think that's our inevitable path, and how we need to return to our pre-like agrarian roots to save the planet.
Oh wow! Okay.
It's interesting.
Well, we shut down the government, so we're on our way. First step.
Yeah. We'll talk about that next week. Let's talk about this week's book.
It's not horrific enough. Next week. Never mind. Yeah, let's talk about the actual book, In the Heart of the Sea.
I'm curious to hear what other people think of this book.
And I'm curious to hear what the person who considers it the best book ever, her personal favorite book ever.
I really do. I mean, I don't know if I should be embarrassed to admit that, but
No, not at all.
I loved this book.
Maybe the V.C. Andrews thing, but no, not this. You know, I mean, what before we get to, you know, into the actual details of what happens in the book, what is it that appeals to you just kind of in general about this book? Right? Do you have a handle on why this is your favorite book?
Yeah, well, this may say a lot about me. It's kind of maybe a little embarrassing, but I've always been fascinated by stories of people trapped at sea or trapped on a deserted island or people suffering. Mm-hmm. I love that kind of thing. I just eat that up. And
no pun intended.
No pun intended. So I think that's part of it.
Okay.
And then, like I said earlier, this was the first time I was able to like pick out the irony in a book, and I felt smart after I was able to figure that out.
I don't know what irony means. Can you explain the irony in the book so maybe I can get it from contextual clues?
I can think of one example of irony in the book.
Oh yeah.
It kind of jumps right into the middle of the thing, but just the kind of it has to do with their choice of where to go at a certain
point. Yeah.
Right.
There's lots of irony in this. So
Can I ask a follow-up question before you jump into whatever you're about to jump into?
Yeah.
That's
me?
Yeah, it's you.
Oh, yeah.
Do you
bastard.
Do you like things – do you like Saw, Dick?
Yeah. Well, I love horror movies.
You do love horror movies.
But I don't like Saw. It depends. Saw, it's that enclosed space I can't handle. I don't like that. But okay. I loved Hostel.
So like Saw. Oh, you loved Hostel.
I did. Okay. Yeah, and I know it's just disgusting, but I love that. Love that movie.
I'm pursuing this train of watching people suffer because I want to know. I want to know why. What about that you enjoy?
By the way, Emily, you're welcome to come with me to the next kid's birthday party that we're invited to, and you can look at me the entire time.
It's Saw themed.
No, I'm just suffering. I'm screaming inside.
Oh, no, I get that. No. That is a fantastic idea, a Saw-themed kid's birthday party.
It would really be cool. They have to like all get out of a trap in order to claim their...
A piñata. Just they should all be in a piñata.
The sad thing is, I used to teach here in Portland, and I taught some kindergarten classes. And the sad thing is there's a certain demographic of you know the socioeconomic status here, where these kids see this stuff, and so this is not as ironic or you know as silly as you're saying. Like I had kindergartners literally come up to me during like free time, and say, "So what's have you seen any of the Saw movies?" Uh huh. What's your favorite death scene from all the Saw movies?
Oh, jeez.
And I said, you know what? I don't really feel comfortable talking about this with you. And
they're kindergartners?
Kindergartners. So we're talking 5 to 6 years old, yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
I can't imagine what.
Nice. I brought the room down.
But back to Emily's love of suffering.
No, that was good. It gave me some time to think about it. Why do I like that? That's a good question.
Well, you're pondering. I mean, I can mm-hmm. think of this. I'm not saying this is your reason, but like one reason why I would enjoy a story like that is I do like to see, and I've even liked it, some reality TV for this reason. I like to see how people react in duress.
Yes,
it's not that I enjoy the details of. Like their dismemberment, which is why I wanted to ask you about those horror movies.
Yeah.
But I like to see, you know, people push to extremes. And I actually really, the part that I usually enjoy the most mm-hmm. is when they show, they do noble things or selfless things or, you know, in situations in which those kind of things would be especially difficult or not expected.
Yes. No, that's what I like. I like to see people get down to their primal level. And then, like you said, I like to see when they can fight back from it.
Yeah, the triumph of humanity through adverse
spirit over. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was going to say, I don't feel like I need to jump to your defense here, Emily, but I'm much like you. Some of my favorite nonfiction books, my first all time favorite nonfiction book is probably Ordeal by Hunger. Since I was a kid, I've been obsessed with The Donner Party. And
that's one on my list right now.
It's so good. I loved it. It was written like in the 20s, maybe early 30s.
Really, that is absolutely right up my alley right there.
Could barely put it down. But, you know, the situation and the strain and all this craziness and then these people who stepped up and did these things in these incredible times, those I mean, I'm not going to say it's a picnic by any means. You know, it's people wasting away, like in this book, and right. All that kind of stuff. But I could not put it down, and I found it riveting. And I finished the book, and I literally looked up the PBS American Experience episode of The Donner Party and watched all four parts on YouTube.
Yeah.
Like, I'm obsessed with that stuff. So
yeah, okay,
I totally.
Good. I'm glad I'm not the only one.
No, it's me as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and if it wasn't clear, I've enjoyed stories like that for that reason too.
Cause
just, you know, people going along in normal situations and I think a lot of times I see the opposite where sometimes I can be struck by just how kind of petty people are and mm-hmm. how they're so concerned with, you know, getting their own over someone else in some really low kind of leverage, low stress situations. And so seeing people actually act really noble and pull together in situations that you might expect them to kind of disintegrate and all become, you know, just out for their own and is always something I like. You know, it's like that when the pops in my head was that movie, The Gray, you know, and things like that.
Yes.
I love watching stuff like that. I love
Me
to
too.
See people succeed in those situations.
I also right. liked this sociological kind of aspect of this book where you're following or the author shares with you kind of like these collections of like, there's these three boats after this event. And here's how, you know, the Nantucketers fared. Here's mm-hmm. how the mainliners fared, and here's how the black people fared.
Exactly.
I right. love those little insights into it.
Me too.
Into the time.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, I had some questions and some thoughts about that and how you guys saw that.
I like learning about just the whole Nantucket culture in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds weird.
It does.
Yeah, it was really odd. And also just sort of the microcosm of it, how it was this very finite period of time where it was this booming industry that yeah. just sort of dissolved
right.
overnight almost.
Like the internet bubble.
Right.
Oh. The .com, you mean?
Exactly, yeah. Nantucket was the first Silicon Valley.
No, but it's just
because it was powering the global economy at the time.
Yeah,
this little tiny island, which is nothing now, it's just a tourist trap.
Right, and yeah, I mean, it was just bizarre to me that you know this culture was so rigorous and it was so insular. Mm-hmm. Like these, you know, people would brag about how fishy their sons were, which you know meant, as you guys know, how ruthless you could be as a captain.
Right. With,
you know, people mm-hmm. on the sea. And these wives would be alone 2 to 3 years at a time at a stretch with their children. Mm-hmm. And this is something that just kind of bore. I mean, until the end, when you're getting to the kind of the epilogue, you don't even hear about any kind of infidelity. There's a case where there's a divorce
right.
of one right. of the survivors. But
well, they're all at sea. So, you know, who are you going to cheat with? the old coot.
I can think of a couple ideas.
Yeah, each other, lesbian orgies.
We're back to penthouse form again.
So that may not have gotten into the records. But
so we always kind of do this, guys. But somebody needs to maybe it could be Emily. Do the Let's thing look. Where there's some people who haven't read the book. Some people just love our personality and our rapport so much they just listen to the show. So can you give a quick rundown of just kind of what this is covering?
Okay. It is about a whale ship called the Essex that sails out to go on a whaling expedition, and they start from Nantucket and go all the way around the Horn of South America out into the Pacific, into the pretty much as far out to sea as, I mean, and I guess they're as far away from land as you could possibly be. And while they're out there, they get headbutted by a giant sperm whale. And
they're all dead if you
sperm. Yes. They're just big, big heads. And then after that, really the story is about their survival and their attempt at survival. Lack thereof.
Out on the open ocean.
And we know this story because the first mate and the captain both survived, and also so did the cabin boy.
Mm-hmm.
And the cabin boy wrote an account which didn't surface until decades later,
right?
But he dictated an account, and then Owen Chase, the first mate, wrote an account much sooner after the events, after his rescue, and the captain also verbally related things that happened, and then. The purpose of this book, I mean, as I saw it, was kind of to take these old accounts and these like first person written accounts with mm-hmm. some contradictory information, because and part of it was contradictory because they actually literally had different experiences, because Owen Chase was not in the same boat as the captain, for example.
Right.
What's the captain's name? I can't remember.
Pollard.
Oh, Pollard. Pollard, Nickerson, and Chase. Okay, thanks.
Nickerson. Oh, Nickerson. Yeah. Okay, I forgot yeah. Nickerson. I was thinking Henderson.
Nickerson, yeah.
There was one more, too.
The second mate was...
right.
I mean, one more survivor. There was a fourth survivor.
Oh, there were more than one more. There was a few more.
There were quite a few.
Yeah, there was like only about half of them died only. Right. But, and there were also the guys on the island, which we can get to.
Right, right.
Which lived. But anyway, so it basically tries to weave together these different things. Mm-hmm. And as we've kind of already mentioned, provide a context of, you know, Nantucket culture, how these whaling expeditions typically work, the economy, why they did this, how they did this, and kind of pull it all together in as coherent a narrative as possible, to give as overall a view of this as possible. With an acknowledgement that some of it is still kind of supposition, you know, it's
right. not
completely known. obviously, a lot of the accounts we're getting are from people who were participants and they had their own reasons maybe to gloss over certain things or
sure.
not mention things at all, or just view things a certain way. So it's an interesting bit of research and historical kind of analysis to do it and give us as good a view of it as we can.
So I think that we've given enough context where we can kind of jump into the first big irony, because the ship has been sunk rapidly by the sperm whale. they had a rough go since they left Nantucket and had already lost a couple whaling ships. So they normally have like 5 or 6, I think, that are out to go. But then at the time this happened, they only had 3 left, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly how many they had.
Yeah, I think it was 3.
So the captain...
And one of those they had to buy...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Peru.
And it was a piece of crap. And so it wasn't even a particularly reliable whaling boat. Because
So the captain, the first mate, and the second mate are given control of each of these 3 whaling boats. And
Matthew Joy, did we say his name?
Joy, that was it. Thank you.
That's right. Yes. I'm bad with names.
So they try to stay together initially and figure out what they're planning to do, because as Emily said, they are out pretty much as far west in the Pacific Ocean as anybody had really been at that point. Any European had been at that point. Sorry. So their view of the world was of the Westward Islands and stuff. The Polynesians were covered just by sailor accounts, just kind of stories, rumors they'd heard.
They had some pretty good charts.
Yeah, they had good charts, but they
didn't necessarily know what they would find there.
Right. So they had a decision to make, and I feel like a lot of this is like a tragedy as far as Pollard's career, because he was the first mate beforehand on the Essex, and this was his first his maiden voyage as a captain, and they got out to sea and initially like I think a day or two out rolled over in a storm, and they considered turning back, and the first mate bullied him, who seemed to be a better captain than he was, bullied him into not doing that, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then later, the same thing kind of happens, that the first mate and the second mate bully him into a decision, because he says, let's go to this nearby, Tahiti?
Was it the Marquesas? Yeah. Or the Society Islands.
Pulling up the map right now. And the Marquesas are right. west and south of where they were rammed. And then there's if you go further south and west, there's French Polynesia, Tahiti, Society Islands.
Yeah. So the Marquesas were the closest island.
Mm-hmm.
And their fear was they had heard that the Marquesan men were cannibals, and that they also performed ritual homosexual acts.
Right.
So there's a twofold fear on the European male here, that there's these scary outward people, outer people, dark people, different people that may eat us. Or if they don't eat us, they could have sex with us.
Sexy time. Yes.
So this abject fear and this ignorance, which is kind of funny because the author points out there were books published by this point, by this journey in 1821, is it, or whatever, that were very clear that this is not really the case. This has happened before, but it's not like daily life. It's not.
Not only that, there was an actual settlement.
Yeah, there was a settlement
on one of these islands that was perfectly prosperous and not being eaten or screwed to death.
So these,
to be fair, I think those were very recent, and it was one of those things where it was like when they were home, a magazine was published or something like that. If they had read it, they would have known. If anybody on the ship had read it, but they didn't. And so they just sort of went a bit, which I know it's sort of easy now to kind of go, oh, they thought they were brown. But what do you think about open ocean and just sailing off into God knows where and who knows what?
They didn't have the internet, needless to say. So it's not just because that information was out there, it's probably a little presumptuous to think they just kind of all should have known,
even so though, I would still choose chance of being eaten or homosexualed, as opposed to just traveling out in the open ocean.
I totally would too. I mean, can I rewind for a real quick second? Just because the Pollard Chase thing, as you've already, Matt, has kind of mentioned, is they've already they clashed a couple times.
Yeah,
it's a big part of it. So, and then even when they both survive, so they're also both giving accounts. the whole rolling over in the ocean thing, that was characterized as being stupid on Pollard's part. He's an experienced seaman. He's been a first mate on a couple of voyages. But even though he seems very indecisive throughout the events of this entire book, and usually therefore gets overruled and having decisions made for him, it was him. I forget the name of the sail.
But basically,
he has this sail up that lets them race before the wind faster and make the best time. He's in a hurry to get where they're going, to the hunting grounds. And a storm is rolling in, and he doesn't lower the sail. And the sail makes them vulnerable to being capsized. They need to lower the sails and kind of, you know, batten down the hatches, so to speak. He waits too long. And then they practically lose their ship as a result. They roll all the way over onto the side, you know, and then they lose whaling boats and so on and so forth. So that was one of his – that's like his first big fuck-up. Mm-hmm. So rewind over back to the present. Cannibals are scary, but I'd like to think that even me not being a sailor would think, well, let's see. The wind blows west. It blows east to west. Maybe we should go west.
Uh-huh.
We can't go against the wind. We're going to go where the wind takes us. You know, and that's the part that got me about that decision was just like, that seemed preordained that you weren't going to, you know, the wind is what it is. And you, as a sailor, you had to know that the wind was kind of an important part of sailing and where you're going to go. And they seemed a little stubborn in thinking, well, no, we're going this way.
Yeah. I mean, they were almost, not considering the wind at all, they're almost as close to New Zealand as they were to
exactly to
you know, Chile.
It just seems that they would want to hit the closest piece of land as soon as possible.
Yeah, that was of any size or that had any food on it. Yeah, and we didn't mention, but that's where they were trying to go. They were trying to go back to South America.
Yeah,
past like the Galapagos Islands and then south down, basically back the way they came, but make landfall. They were going to go south and then east, supposedly, and land in like Chile.
So did,
like Valparaiso or something.
Yeah, that was mentioned, I think. Yeah.
So you know, I'm a hippie and all, and whatever, pretty hard left wing. But did that drive anybody else nuts? That sequence where they stop in the Galapagos and the Joker kid takes a torch and lights a bushfire and then destroys this entire
burns down
ecology.
That killed me. And then not to mention the tortoises. I couldn't handle that. Yeah. That was too much. Yeah. And then they said that even has left remnants to today. It really destroyed that island.
The burning, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jackass.
To me, that was sort of one of the other big ironies of the book is that, you know, even though it is a sort of a tale of extreme suffering and you know, human spirit overcoming, it feels kind of karmic in a lot of ways. Their ship gets destroyed by the whale, after they've been out, you know, killing whales. And then, like you said, all that ecological damage they did for no reason. The guy's like, "I set the island on fire." Durr.
It's pretty funny, though.
That's hilarious, guys.
Why did he do that?
Well, I don't know. Even the captain ringed him out. Like, this was not socially acceptable even back then, you know?
Yeah.
They were like, "What the fuck is wrong with you, dude?"
Yeah.
You just hit an island
like a psychopath.
I mean, most
you
of
just
the things,
killed God knows how many creatures.
Most of the things they were doing were not unusual. I mean, back in that, I remember actually reading this book about many years ago, but it was basically the history of man's relationship to animals. And for much of human history, the overriding view of animals was that they existed for us, for our use, period.
Yeah.
And that was certainly true in the early 1800s, you know. So,
gotta read Ishmael, bro. You gotta read Ishmael.
hunting whales, obviously, was their livelihood. Hunting turtles, didn't think anything of that. They all, you know, people all did that kind of stuff. But the burning the island down thing, that was pretty perilous.
That sounded like a psychopath.
Yeah, that's what sets people apart. You know, we still do that today. People eat hamburgers, but it doesn't mean that you just walk up to a cow and shoot in the head for a reason. Yeah.
Well, you're destroying the system of nature that provides you with that food that you can take so, you know, liberally and some may say callously. But the point is, like, destroying that system hurts you just as much as it hurts
Ishmael.
It'll answer it all for me. It'll just.
It's all about it, bro. It's the levers and the takers. It's actually, quite a bit about this. what Jason's talking about.
I'm curious.
I'll put a, they're coming for us.
Can you hear that really well?
Then, are you outside?
I also thought that was sort of...
You guys can hear that really clearly. No, I live right on, right off of 39th or Cesar Chavez.
Yes, please.
So.
Cesar Chavez.
We're very politically correct, as I'm sure you've noticed from listening to our show.
Cesar A. Chavez Boulevard. So, anyway, sorry about that traffic going
by.
It's
okay, man. You're urban. I get it.
I'm urban.
What am I doing? Oh, Ishmael. Is that all? Oh, is this called Ishmael?
It's called Ishmael. It's by Daniel
Cole. I'm gonna add it to my list.
And it's very polarizing. If you look at the reviews, they're either 5 or 1 star.
Oh,
I like those kind.
Yeah.
It sounds like it. It sounds like it could really be insipid.
Yeah. I'm halfway through, and I'm not sure whether I love it or hate it yet.
Okay.
And
those kind of things, it really comes down to, did they end up speaking to you? Did the ideas of the author vibe with you? Because if they don't, you're just going to be rolling your eyes and going, oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm just not sure I can go to the extreme of saying, so you're saying we go back to pre-agrarian times, which would basically be genocide for probably 2/3 of the population of the planet because we can't sustain life anymore.
Right.
Hey guys, I need to get a reload real quick. Do you want to take a break or talk without me? I'd love to hear what you say though.
So don't talk without him.
Talk about something else.
What can we talk about?
Okay. I'll keep talking about the Galapagos because there was.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
End point that was... now.
Okay.
Ishmael. What about the Galapagos?
Yeah. that was actually the fact that, you know, that fire that they set there was another big irony because they were about as close to the Galapagos when their ship got rammed as they were to the Marquesas, which they already knew because they had just been there. So they could have just gone there, which were filled with, you know, all kinds of creatures.
Well, I'm sure did
they ever even discuss that?
That just wasn't an option. They discussed
it because they just burned it down. They couldn't go back.
They didn't burn it down. There's still people there. No, I think there was some reason why they just couldn't go that direction at that time. You know, a weathery and windy reason. Because I'm sure that was not lost on them that, you know, we could
I don't remember that being up for discussion in them when they were deciding where to go.
Let's see. Here's the plan. Maybe I could find out. I'll never find it. Of course. There's no way. This is talking about the difference in leadership philosophies.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so he talks about how he doesn't really sound like it, though, but supposedly the captain is very fishy, so he's kind of, as in the cold connotation, like he's very analytical and cold and just practical. And then the first mate is more, he exhorts the men, he can relate to the men more, he can be really hard on them, but he also can be the one that's kind of the good guy. And on this ship... It was kind of interesting because Pollard was more concerned about being a good guy and kind of getting on with the men than your typical captain. And Owen Chase was the kind of the more aggressive, fiery, ambitious man of action type.
He was just more of a leader.
It certainly sounded like he considered himself a leader. Like, you know,
definitely.
He knew what to do. Now, whether or not that was the right thing to do, I think we already
arrogantly thought.
Because I mean, if they had gone the other direction, then they probably would have been fine. So, let's see.
Oh, here it is. Backtracking the way to the Galapagos and beyond that to South America, a trip of more than 2,000 miles meant bucking both the southeasterly trade winds and a strong west flowing current.
Okay.
Pollard deemed it impossible.
And apparently no one disagreed that that was impossible. So
yeah, weirdly.
Well, it
maybe
may,
it was.
It may
I don't
have
know.
Been impossible. Yeah, that's kind of why I thought that it made most sense to just go with the way the wind and the waves were actually going to push them anyway. Because they were pretty much at the mercy of that, whether they liked it or not.
Oops.
Well, they did follow. They had. That's why they were going back against the wind, because they had to follow parallel down the coast.
Because there was some kind of current
southeast trade winds.
There was some band there that was supposedly going to push them the direction they wanted to go.
That would push them back into shore.
Yeah. But they even called like variable winds or something. It had some kind of name that even implied like you can't really count on it, but we might hit this little kind of fold here where it might work out for us. Yeah. Hubris.
In several stories like this, I've always heard that like the worst thing that ends up happening is when there's no wind.
Yeah.
And you just sit there. So like
and rot.
Yeah, we don't have food forever here.
Those were some of the parts that I felt myself most viscerally when they described them just sitting there with the sun beating down on them.
Yeah.
I could actually feel that. This was made me thirsty.
When they talked
good
about
descriptions of bodily kind of situation.
They talked about that.
And
that,
what happens when you die of thirst.
Right. Yeah, the university study about people who willingly starved. And
right.
That, those descriptions of your tongue swelling up. And it was just.
It was pretty grisly.
It was very visceral.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. I think probably a lot of times we don't think of all of the things that happens to the body. It's just like, oh yeah, you get really hungry for a long time and then you die. Well, not quite. It's worse than that. And then, right. And then just the exposure to the salt water and exposure to the sun and these people.
Yeah, to me, it was even more fascinating. It was sort of the process of recovery and how difficult that is. Cause you know, at first I was going, you know, when they hit that other island, and they eat for about a week and then say, okay, we don't have enough to sustain us, I don't think. So we're going to go ahead and take off, and we've got a little bit in our pockets. And then I was like, well, they just ate for a week. Now they're back to square one, right?
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not quite.
No, it takes way longer to recover.
That's how it's not. That's not right. The case, yeah.
And that they can actually lose weight, or they could have lost weight while they were eating that food for that week.
So I was thrilled that that party survived.
Speaking of which, the island, so they do encounter an island. I don't remember what the name of it was. It was a small little coral reef.
Henderson Island.
And that was Henderson.
Yeah.
That was Henderson. Okay.
Yeah.
Hickerson Island. Nick Seeger. Sorry.
They thought it was Ducey, right?
Thought it was what?
They thought it was Ducey Island.
Yeah, they did.
And they figured out, well, no, it's not. Right. But so this island that they end up on, of course, the main consideration – even beyond food is water, fresh water. Mm-hmm. And they realize after a bunch of searching that there's a freshwater spring that is periodically above the surface of the ocean, but only periodically. It's like the tide comes in and out, and sometimes it's there and sometimes it's covered up. But they realize this, and they have some fresh water and refill their barrels and all that. And then there's some things on the island they can eat, like birds. And ultimately they decide that it's not going to be enough to support them, and that the chance of this whole time they're hoping not just to get somewhere, but that maybe they'll run into another ship. And they just don't think that's going to happen out there. But there's three guys? Is it three? Two or three?
Yeah, it's three guys.
Three guys. Three guys decide to stay, and they survive. And one of the interesting things to me about that is, well, you could say they made a good decision to stay because they all lived. But if they had all stayed, there wouldn't been enough to support all of them probably. Right.
I mean, because it said that by the time that the guys got rescued, that they were
done.
Spring
they were
was
out.
Underwater completely. And they were almost out of food.
Yeah. They were like licking water from a crack in the cliff face. Like I think by the time the main party left.
And they had already found all the skeletons on the island of people who had already starved.
Exactly. They already knew people died there.
Right. A party of eight, I think.
Right.
So they kind of lucked out. And in a way, they also – it was interesting. I mean, karmically, that actually really worked out for them because it enabled those three to survive, because that was just apparently the exact right balance point for how many resources this island could – you know, had. And, of course, eventually a ship found them. Mm-hmm. Also, by taking three people out of the boats – that was three fewer people who were consuming the hardtack and the water on the boats, making it slightly more possible for those people to survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
So splitting that up and getting two different sources, even if both were crap, was kind of a key, I think, to some, you know, more people actually living through this.
Even though that wasn't really their strategy, though.
No, not at all.
Yeah,
not at all. It was just
they're just winging it. But then that's just the way it turned out.
You know who was the luckiest person is the guy who ran away before the ship.
Yes.
I know, the guy that jumped ship before the Galapagos.
Right.
He knew something.
He was like, I'm out of here. I don't know about these people.
Yeah. Well, he's like, yeah. Well, was that before or after the captain let the ship flop over on its side?
Oh, that was months after. That. Months after.
Okay, yeah. So he's like, I don't have faith in the leadership.
Trust this guy.
Yeah.
Cracker ass crackers.
So speaking of, that guy was black that ran away.
That's right, what I just said.
You didn't just said that. Okay, sorry. So speaking of, way back in the beginning here, Matt, I think, mentioned, one of you mentioned, the way that there were three kind of distinct groups on the ship, on the boats. There was the Nantucketers, there was the Offlanders, like from Cape Cod and so
Koofs,
and then there were the black people who, you know, were often the cooks and so on the ship. And they divvied up, they had three boats originally. They had a second mate, Matthew Joy, also had a boat. And they divvied up the crews and basically, you know,
it's like picking a team in gym.
It was like picking a team. And, you know, the black people were all of the gangly kids with thick glasses and nobody went on their team. And then the off islanders were kind of like, okay, if we have to. You know, but they wanted the Nantucketers the most. And not necessarily because they were more able-bodied or better sailors or anything like that, but it was just...
It was their in-group.
It was their
in-group. Yeah.
Right. They just wanted to be who they're comfortable with.
Yeah. Now, eventually...
Because sorry to interject here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just for a little context, because these all of the power players on Nantucket were Quakers. And so the Quakers stuck to their own lifestyle and their own group very hard, and also they were... rabid abolitionists. So it wasn't a race thing. It was more about being comfortable, like Emily is saying, with your own.
Right. And who was the one? There was some fairly prominent, I think it was Matthew Joy, was not a Quaker. He was a Congregationalist or something like that. It made a point of that.
Yeah, I do remember, but I don't remember who it was, though.
It was a Nantucketer, but he was not a, I'm pretty sure it was Matthew Joy. It was somebody who was fairly, you know, high up. The hierarchy,
right.
But he was still kind of not as high.
It wasn't Pollard? I thought it was Pollard.
Yeah, there were a few people who were, you know,
outside
not
the,
necessarily
the friends.
Outsiders. But
what do they call them? The Friends?
Had, yeah, friends?
Yeah,
the Friends.
The Society of Friends.
I think.
Oh, that's right.
What, didn't Chase even have a thing where, or no, it was Coffin maybe, where like his family had left the island for a while and then he went back.
Well, Nickerson.
For being disowned or kicked out or something.
Nickerson was, I think that was Nickerson.
Went
it was
to,
Nickerson?
Yeah, like New York or something like that and came back.
I thought maybe it was Coffin, too. There were a few of them that had sort of similar stories of, you know, kind of being kicked out and invited back into this friendship circle. It was like this weird mob mentality going on.
So
mob / cult.
I did want to ask what you guys think about. So we had these different. We had this divvied up. So the Matthew Joy's boat had like four black guys in it, and one and Matthew Joy himself, and then one other guy.
One koof.
And then there was, I think, just one other black guy sailor, and he was in actually the captain's boat, I think. No. He was in.
He was in Chase's boat.
And he was the old guy,
spiritual guy that led the prayer.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, so people have made, you know, basically when they started to run out of food and they started to die and they started to eat them, the dead people, the black people all got eaten first. They all died and were eaten first. And there was a lot of explanation in the book about why that may have been. You know, the fact that they didn't eat as well as the other crew members to begin with on the ship. Their rations were not as good or as much, so they were already starting from a deficit, and so it would make sense that they would die first. The old guy was old, and so there were reasons that were posited. But
the main one I thought was that they were sort of a more muscular build, and muscle eats away faster. They didn't have as much natural fat on their bones.
Right, that was one of the reasons too.
Right, that was another one. But it's still what made me wonder about it the most was the fact that they did get all – eventually they were all separated. They tried to stay together for a while, but they weren't able to. And the two primary people we have that wrote this account were in the same boat and were not the boat with most of the black people in it.
Right.
Mm.
You know, and so I'm not quite sure, like, I don't think we have a really reliable record of exactly what went down.
Right.
You know? I mean, we know, for example, that one of the people in Chase's boat was actually killed. No.
Yeah, I was going to say that's
right. Are we allowed to say that?
What?
Is that a spoiler? Okay. Because really, when it came down to it, only one person was actually murdered.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That was a coffin kid, right?
Right. Right.
Which to me, that one was like a big scene for me on my second read.
Right.
For some reason I didn't remember it, but reading it this time, that one really hit home. The fact, you know, the drawing of lots, and you know, the fact that it was really sort of his own choice.
Well, that,
that's what I thought.
And that he pressured Pollard into it.
That's what I thought was
so strange. It almost felt unnecessary. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but obviously I wasn't there. I wouldn't know how that would feel. But it seems like they were doing just fine with people dying off naturally.
Right. Yeah. I know.
Well, they were like, well, I want breakfast, so one of us has got to go. Oops, it's me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've read books about, as I mentioned, the Donner Party and the Andes soccer team. Mm-hmm. And no one went to that length there.
Right.
And these are amazingly trying times. So it was that was particularly disturbing to me too, that it went there.
Me too.
And it was Pollard's nephew or something.
Yes.
Husband or,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
which that was another one. Like when he goes back and tells his aunt.
Yeah. Like, I need to deliver that news.
Take care of my son.
Yeah.
But I ate him.
Take a poop and then goes. Ate him. There he is right there. It felt like, you know, one thing that Chase did do very well, according to these accounts, which is largely Chase's account, but one of the things that he did do very well is he tried to make the provisions last as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
It actually really pissed me off when, like, I kind of put myself briefly into that position where his boat had metered out. He had metered out these provisions very carefully, and they still had some left. But Matthew Joy's boat, they'd eaten all of theirs because for one thing, he was sickly, and Matthew Joy was one of the first to die, if not the first. But basically, they just ate more than they were supposed to for how they had worked this out. And then, you know, they're starving, so they're like, well, give us some of yours. Which is, at the same time, it's kind of a human thing. Well, okay, we're not going to let our crewmates starve. But on the other hand, it's like, you just ruined our chance to survive too.
Right.
And talk about a hard choice. It's like, you know, if we're going to still have a chance to survive, no, we can't give you any. But when they start, it seems like once they do run out of provisions and they start to eat their dead, that they just kind of lose kind of the control over being able to live without food and deal with the cravings and deal with the massive hunger. And they're just kind of...
It's like they become more animal-like.
They're just like, well, we're just going to go for it here. So I don't know if that has... we're out of food again and we're still hungry, so...
Yeah, that was a wonderful opening to the
and
book.
And that is the boat that disappears, so maybe Pollard and Chase ganged up on those guys and said, you ate all your food.
that is the one that disappears. I really don't feel like we know exactly what happened to that boat.
No.
For various reasons.
Did you guys wonder, maybe I didn't have a good sense of the size of those boats, but...
You could probably Google it.
How did they eat them? Was that ever made clear? I think at one point they mentioned fire.
Yeah, they said that they were making fires in the bottom of the boat.
Okay, I just couldn't picture that. I guess maybe in my head
you pictured
the boat
that?
seems small.
Well, they remember they said that one of the first people that died, they cut into strips and laid out to dry in the sun, and they turned kind of green. Yeah. So they went rancid. Yeah, they went rancid, so they threw that away and just decided to.
I thought they went ahead and ate it. They're like, we better eat this quick.
I love that that there's this instinctual thing, like with the tortoises, when they kill the tortoises and eat them, and then when they run out, when a human person dies and they eat that, like, you immediately go for the heart and the liver. Like, there's this kind of intuitive, like, I know where the nutrients are.
Nutrient rich, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's creepy.
I had to sympathize drinking also with blood. At some point there was a few that refused to drink the blood. Mm-hmm. I couldn't help but think, yeah, that would have been me. Yeah. I could not.
That's a step too far.
I would have been sucking on your thigh bone. I'd break your femur in half. And
you talk about that anyway.
Sucking the marrow out.
When you're not particularly hungry.
Marrow is delicious.
It is.
There was that guy that way back on the Galapagos before they were even, you know, having trouble. What happened to him? They were all carrying turtles back, and something happened to him, and he got separated, and then – long story short, he ended up butchering a turtle and drinking its blood.
That's right.
To get back to the ship. I'm like, that's hardcore.
It's a thirst quencher, though. If you haven't tried it, try it.
Really?
Yeah, it's like a Bud Light on a 100-degree day after painting nails. Oh.
It seems so thick.
It is, but it's refreshing.
It's refreshing.
You guys remember that scene in Twilight where they drink the turtle blood?
Oh, man.
I do not know what you're talking about.
And then they have turtle powers? they can pull their heads into their torsos? It's awesome.
That was the good part of that book.
It was the best part. What else, guys? Anything else?
Can I say the irony, the part that I like so much?
Yes.
Yes, please.
And that – pretty simple. I guess it's pretty obvious. Now that I read it the second time, it was actually stated at one point. But it's just funny that they probably could have survived, or all of them, if they had just made way for the Marquesas. But they avoided it because of the fear of cannibalism and then just the irony of them becoming cannibals eventually.
That's a Monty Python type of sketch or something.
I thought, that is cool.
And they may have gotten horny out there, too. We don't know.
Exactly. You know, that crossed my mind several times.
That in the account.
I doubt that happens.
I did get the impression that I would be bored shitless reading the actual accounts. Because they're like the same thing every time. They're written in this way that's – how do I describe it? I mean, it's just kind of it's both matter of fact and it's also kind of, I don't know,
horny?
Lofty, like, you know, like
lofty.
You know, destiny is pulling us this
That's
way.
That's a great word. Lofty is right.
I don't know. But it seemed like it would be just tedious to read. And you would almost, I feel like you could read it and then you could get to the end and then you could read this and you're like, holy shit, really? They ate each other? Like, you know, you wouldn't even know it from the account.
Right.
You know, maybe not, but I'd feel like that would be kind of what would happen.
I thought you were going to say that it would be tedious to be just on the water with these people.
Well, it would be. But
I was going to say, I would entertain you.
I'm sure you would.
Do you know how many songs I know? Hundreds. Well,
forever lost at sea, I'll find out.
Sit right back in your heel, a tale of a tale. I mean, I know lots of songs.
Sing that one. Yeah.
100,000 bottles of beer on the wall.
Yes.
I'll take you to.
That's the club, the 12-inch club.
At least Easter Island, right?
Yeah, totally.
Did you?
Well, that's the stuff I thought was missing from the book, was like all those details of what they did.
Yeah, they did all
How many games of tic tac toe?
Yeah. Well, they made that twine. That one guy did.
That one guy, yeah.
Yeah,
the one
twine.
Guy.
He made it work.
That twine he was like braiding whatever. And that was sad, you know, the in the epilogue that as the industry faded away and this and Nantucket's prominence went with it, it became a tourist town, as Emily said earlier, and even like there's very few remnants of this huge thing that was such a big deal, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Was it?
They're not particularly proud of this bit of their history, is what it sounded like.
Well, yeah, but it was a huge sensation at the time. You know what I mean? Like, Chase's account that was published, what, like a year or two later, a year and a half later, mm-hmm. Was a bestseller. And, well, I understand that, but I mean, like all they, like, what were the two things that were left? Like, there was like a jaw from a giant sperm whale that was considerably smaller than the one that actually supposedly sunk this ship, and then that little rope that the guy had made. Like, that's their mm-hmm.
right.
That's their
the
legacy
of it. Mm-hmm.
Although, I mean, they have. Well, it's not. I mean, in the museum it is, but it seemed like he may have derived inspiration from a variety of sources, but it seemed like Herman Melville really did base Moby Dick very heavily on this event.
I guess we didn't mention Melville at all,
which is quite a legacy. And it was interesting that, you know, it obviously bears some resemblance to it, just in the sense that it's a whale that rams a ship. And that was something that wasn't, at that point, it hadn't really happened. It hadn't really been recorded that had happened, although it happened many times in the years after, almost like the whales were just kind of getting fed up or learning that they could fight back. But the Captain Ahab kind of thing happened with a completely different captain, a completely different ship, the same year that Moby Dick was published. So obviously Melville wasn't aware of it when he was writing this book, but there was actually a guy whose ship was rammed, and then he set off after the whale, like hunted it down, like Ahab
right.
did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was kind of interesting.
I thought so too.
Yeah.
What did you guys think?
The potential explanation okay. for why the whale attacked was when he were talking about how they were hammering.
Right. I liked that part of it. I liked that he just made, I thought that was interesting that he made it sound like, I don't know. It was just more of an animal instinct, something that they do anyway.
Another bull off.
Exactly. I thought that. I don't remember that. I didn't remember that from the first time I read it. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Like, did the whale have any idea that he was ramming a ship?
Exactly.
Or even what a ship was. But, you know,
right.
Was it just like another animal that was in his hunting ground? Maybe, you know, maybe he was horny and he was like, you know, his
right.
was nearby and it was like,
they
oh,
happen to be
oh,
making
no,
these sounds.
No. Yeah.
It sounds not very much like
peculiarly like a beating ball or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems more, I mean, it seems more likely than to, yeah. Although they all wanted to seemingly from the accounts, they wanted to give it an intelligence, a malevolence, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
like
it was out to get him.
It was out to get him.
Think about yeah. how much providence plays into every little burp and fart, you know, in their lives.
True.
So, you know, they think God is coming down and rubbing their tummy every time they take
That's
a shit.
True.
So,
yeah, bless this voyage. Let us get our 2,600 barrels of oil.
Right.
The descriptions of the whaling industry were horrifying from the first quarter of the book.
I thought so too.
I mean, where they're, you know, you hear these things about Europeans coming into these places and decimating these populations and just, you know, scalping something or skinning something and just throwing this carcass. But I mean, this is on such a grand scale.
Mm-hmm.
They're cutting blubber off of a part of it and then essentially cracking this skull open that's like more like a cartilage and just pulling out these just gallons, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of gallons of this crude stuff that they named spermaceti because it apparently looked like semen, I guess.
Right.
At least
yeah,
when
yeah.
it made contact with oxygen.
That's why they're called sperm whales.
Yeah. And I mean, this description of cooking down this stuff is so ghastly and slipping around.
Yeah.
And,
what, yeah,
yeah.
Slipping
and
around
the smell,
on the deck.
You know, like it sounds like it makes a hog rendering plant smell pleasant. It's rough stuff.
It is.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, I felt like some of this was like, you guys asked for this. You know, like I know it's easy to go back to time travel and finger wag and whatever, you know, trash talk to the ghosts of the past. But
go talk to the Japanese, man. didn't it say
they're still doing it?
That's right. Didn't it say somewhere, though, that the despite all of this.
But they make rape porn, so I can't get mad at them.
Panty porn. He loves those panty vending machines.
I do. That's why I went to Japan.
Didn't it say that the sperm whale population actually, though, rebounded really well? Like,
yeah.
It's actually one of the most of the larger whales. It's one of the most populous.
Yes.
Right. Compared to
really
the right whale.
It was really in the
20th
century.
Right. It was the right whale that was, I think the right right whale was extinct?
I think they're gone now, actually.
Oh, God. That's
like in the last 10 years, I think they're gone.
I never even heard of a right whale.
Oh, they're way better than the left ones.
Yeah, totally. No, I thought it meant like, you know, I don't know how many blue whales there are out there. Or
right whales can see Alaska from their front door.
They can only
sorry
right.
Russia.
That's okay. Why they that's why they died out. They can never go left.
Oh,
not a problem. Yeah.
That's sad.
That's sad.
Okay, they're endangered. They're not extinct yet. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Though it does sound like, even though it sounds like most of the sperm whale decimation happened during the 20th century, actually, it sounds like the really large ones sort of became extinct. Like, you know, 80 feet sounds enormous now, but that at that time it may have been fairly average.
Right.
Well, yeah, but I thought the impression was from like what the reports were that it was the largest one they'd ever seen.
Yeah, maybe it was still a bit above average.
But
you get the impression though that there were Goliaths in that day, and we farmed those out. Like we killed all the males, so you know, or most of the big males, so we kind of damned them to have smaller offspring.
I don't know that we know it was 85 feet long, though. I mean, it's
well, yeah, that's a reckoning based on perception. Yeah. So
I mean, and if you were ran by a whale and you lost your ship. Would you be like, yeah, it was like 30 feet long,
little guy.
Wore a pink ribbon? No, you'd be like, it had a battering ram on its head, and it had this crazy eye.
Tearing a chainsaw.
Brass knuckles.
I think.
Yeah. I had a chance to stab it in the face. But...
Okay, right, guys, story straight. How big was this thing?
How many horns did it have? Yeah. That was another thing. Was that Chase? I think it was Chase.
Yeah.
At one point early in the, like, well, when they were getting rammed by it, because it rammed twice before. The first time didn't actually do that much damage, and then the second one stove it in. He had a chance to harpoon it, to stab it, and he didn't because he was afraid that something was going to happen. Like, it was.
Then he would go crazy and.
Yeah, and, like, destroy the ship. That way,
right.
or something.
Yeah.
So he made that call, and then, of course, it ended up being well. We don't know if it's the wrong one because, for all we know,
right, it could have gone either way.
It could have been bad if he had done that. I thought that Bulk made one kind of logical error, though, and I don't know maybe if I remember this correctly, but it seemed like they were talking later about a food source that they. Oh yeah, sharks. They were talking about that they could have hunted sharks. Like they were saying. There were some potential food sources that they didn't actually think of that some people in some other voyages that survived did.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was sharks. Like they could have thrown things overboard.
I just cut the fin off and make soup. I throw the rest away.
You're very, very wasteful, Matt. But what got me about that is that they were describing, by that point, they were describing them as being so weak that they couldn't even like move
around. They couldn't
around.
Get through the cartilage.
So there was no way they couldn't have killed the sharks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Right, they tried.
Shoot, a shark even attacked him at one point, right? And they had a chance. And they were like trying to stab it, and they're like, we can't.
They're just like, just like pricking him.
Just kind of poked it until it...
Yeah, like picturing Mr. Burns, like, poking him.
That's probably a good description for their general level of strength once it runs.
Yeah, they were a bunch of Mr. Burns.
Slapping it. No.
No.
The thing about the whole, okay, let's eat each other thing is by the time they did it, there wasn't much to eat.
Yeah.
It's true. There's no fat left.
Oh, gnarly.
I know. That's why I'm eating you first, Jason.
Oh, well, then that reminds me of the other little tidbit that I thought was really cool about why the... To this day, the Samoans tend to be so heavy set is because evolutionarily speaking, to survive, to get out that far to those islands, you have to be bigger boned.
Right.
And so like the little skinny people never made it out there. So the remnants.
Never got their groove on.
Exactly. I thought that was cool. That was a cool little tidbit.
Yeah, I think this is fascinating. I love that anthropology of that in the story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, final thoughts? Anybody got final thoughts? No.
Did you guys like it?
I liked it a lot.
Oh, good.
I love this book.
I hope Dave liked it because he read it twice.
This is the second time I've read it. I liked it just as much the second time.
Me too.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a question. Who read the notes?
Not me.
No. There's no reason to read the notes.
Oh, I read all the stuff next to the pictures.
Okay, right. So none of us read the notes. I just didn't know if I was.
I read like the first couple pages of them and said, "There's nothing here."
Yeah. I think it was Dave.
He's just going into more detail about where he found stuff.
I feel like I trust him.
Whether or not that would have been. It just fleshed out, backed up what he already brought up a little bit more for people who want to say, okay, well, what's your sources and what's the full quote that you quoted? And but yeah, it doesn't seems fairly unnecessary for the narrative. I liked it.
How many stars did you give it, Jason?
I don't know if I've given it any stars yet.
You don't even know what you're doing.
I don't know that I've rated it.
You're doing it wrong. Yeah.
I liked it. I felt like I probably could have shaved about 50 pages off of it. But
it's so lean already.
I didn't think so. I mean, it felt like it. Nah, I felt like it just kind of came around to the same stuff a lot. But I did enjoy it, and it was a very well put together book. I felt like the research was good and meticulous. One of the things that struck me reading this that was kind of interesting to me was, we've talked about on the show nonfiction a little bit, and I've revealed that I haven't read much. And it's interesting, and we call it fiction as in made up, and we call this nonfiction, like this is all true. But to me, in a lot of ways, this is just as much fiction, because you know what I mean? When you're piecing together stories like this and you're using the kind of sources that you use for this sort of thing, you're creating an account that's part fiction, part history. You're not sure where those borders are. And
okay, Neo, hold on. Okay.
Your philosophy.
You're blowing my mind.
Ishmael, thank you. That's my name. Yeah, I know, it's kinda interesting. So but I did like reading it, and I would like to know things about the world. So I'm gonna read some more nonfiction.
So let's say
I was just gonna say, I read Mayflower, which was another book by the same author, and it is not that good. So there's one
You know why? No cannibalism.
Tracking down the author.
There's no one suffered. There just was not enough suffering.
Freaking pilgrims, man. That's all.
Yeah.
So, Jason, if let's say there were some type of scale, let's say there were 5 stars. How many stars would you give this book on a scale of, say, 5 stars?
Does it go? Does it start at 0? Or does it start at 1?
I believe it starts at 1.
It starts at 1.
Right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
How many reviews have you read that say, "I wish I could give this 0 stars," but
yes.
Well, lots, but
we be them.
I want a 10-point scale because I want to give it a 3.5. Actually, is what I want.
Out of 10?
All right.
No, out of 5. He's saying out of
a 7.
If it were 10 points, yeah, you give it a 7.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
I'm just kind of going by it was not amazing for me personally. Mm-hmm. It's somewhere between liked it and really liked it. I liked it a lot. I'll give it 4 stars.
So
give it 4 stars. Being dead, in my heart, I don't love cannibalism quite as much as you guys.
So being dead inside makes you give it how many stars? 4? 3.5?
I gave it 5 both times.
I gave it,
but of course, I'm partial to Stories of the Sea,
and
cannibalism, and and eating people on the open water.
Yes.
Matt gave
you and I are right on the same track.
Yes, I was going to say you guys have the same scoring
system.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you watch Survivor?
I do not.
Oh.
I have not, I should say.
Okay.
So I give it 4.
But are there cannibals on that?
It's also dead.
So. No, there's no cannibalism, so that's too bad. Mm. Yeah, that would make a great show.
The ratings would be fucking awesome.
Yeah, they would.
Yeah. I would probably watch it then. All I saw from the previews is like whiny white people going, eh, we have to survive where other people already live.
You're going to see whiny white people suffer.
That's pretty cool.
But they're like in already inhabited islands, aren't they?
No.
They usually go to like some place where people that are already there. And
they're definitely not just dumped on a remote island.
And they're like, but we don't have cell phone reception.
I think one of them took place on the Marquesas.
Yeah, they did. Really? One of them did. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Wow, that's cool.
The ritual rape thing was awesome.
I would be rooting for ritual rape and cannibalism.
Yeah. So I really like this book. I kind of think that I have a law of primacy kind of issue going with, like, I have the same interest in the stuff that Emily does, but the first one that I read that was in this genre was Ordeal by Hunger. So
that has to have more stars than this.
So that, since that was the first one I read, it kind of really blew me away, so I gave that 5 stars, and for me, I kind of measure everything against that, and I think that they all can't measure up to it. So
that's a high recommendation. I'm going with that one next.
Good. I read. Please talk to me about it when you do.
Okay.
I read Alive after that, which I loved. Which is also 4 stars, and this is 4 stars. But I feel
that
like
that was the Pearl Jam story, right?
Yes. The Pearl Jam Andy's plane crash story. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like
you were stuck in a boat with Eddie Vedder for 3 months. Holy shit.
I don't think he could sing after a little while.
I don't think, yeah, that'd be the good part when he didn't sound constipated and Cher. So I love this.
He wants to eat Eddie.
I love this, and I love Alive. They're just, I have the law of primacy thing going where it's like that my first exposure was my first love, so. For me, it's all about Ordeal by Hunger, but this is a brilliant book. He did a great job sewing this stuff together and kind of, you know, getting some themes going and revisiting things and this and that. So I loved it, and thank you so much for sharing it with us, Emily.
Oh, I'm glad you guys liked it. Good. I was nervous.
Don't
a little
be
worried.
No.
Okay.
Please.
Good. I'm going
to be nervous. Well, yeah, that was cool.
All right.
So well,
that's my final thought.
Yeah. So next month is this month is October, which is the best month of the year.
And
for
you're
a bunch
watching,
of reasons.
What, a horror movie every day or something?
I am. I'm doing 31 Days of Horror. Yeah, I'm going to watch a horror movie every day. Halloween is my favorite holiday, in case people haven't figured this out.
Do you show your kids The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the cartoon one?
I haven't yet, no.
She's, the cartoon's good.
That's a great one.
She's very gun shy. This is her first year of being totally into Halloween. Like,
oh, okay.
She's really into it this year, so she wants to watch some stuff. So, I'll dig out my Universal horror movie, you know, box sets and show her Frankenstein or Wolfman or something. But take it easy. But anyway, this is my favorite month because it's got my birthday in it, it's got Dave's birthday in it, and it's got Halloween in it, and there's college football happening. These are all.
It is a good month. I'm highlights of my life. With you there.
So, for
I'll
that,
even add in shit that you don't care about, like baseball playoffs. And
yeah, fuck that.
NFL football. And,
yeah, fuck that too. So,
my daughter's birthdays.
That's awesome.
Oh yeah, that.
Oh yeah.
My point being,
way above, lagging behind the other.
We are reading The Great God Pan by Arthur Machen. I believe that's how you pronounce it. It's a public domain book. It was written over 100 years ago, so you're welcome to. You know, grab it from the Gutenberg Project or anywhere online, even Wikipedia, you can grab this book. It's a seminal book in the horror evolution, you know, up to Lovecraft, and even Stephen King praised this book. So we'll be discussing that for a Halloween episode, and I guess we'll have a guest, Jason, is that correct?
Yeah, friend of the podcast, Lawrence Rosales. He also does his own podcast that Dave and I have both appeared on of
I'll be there.
Short horror fiction or short other genre fiction.
I'm going to be on there.
Yeah. Matt's going to be on there.
Emily's going to be on there.
He's promised that he's going to write a story eventually and be on there. So, yeah, he is he's going to join us to do The Great God Pan, of course, and then he's just kind of a horror fan in general and horror writer, so we will have a good Halloween show.
I'm very excited to talk about that.
That sounds good. Yeah. I'll read along.
Thank you. Everybody, read along.
It's short.
It's free.
It's a novella.
And short.
Yes.
Free and short is good.
Okay, so, Jason, do you want to say where they can find us?
Of course you do.
We reside over in our textual form at the goodreads.com website, which if you go to the search for the groups, not just in the general search, but groups, Bookhouse Boys, you'll find us. Join us, post, just say hi, tell us what you're reading, talk about the book we're reading. Be awesome. All four of us are actually also on Twitter.
Thank you.
Variations of our names. No. Dave is not on Twitter.
I miss Dave.
I miss you too, Dave.
Yeah.
I don't know why all I was doing was like retweeting crazy shit.
I still miss you.
I was like, I have to go. Yeah. I have to put this aside now. I'm losing my mind.
Maybe someday again.
I've thought that on many occasions.
He's settled and sober and just feeling great.
Maybe
he'll be back.
I still miss
him. We will embrace him with open arms.
Sometimes I still tweet you, even though I know you're
there. Yeah, I do. I was like, wait a minute, I don't think this is working. How come it's not autofilling? Spelling this right? Yeah. But I'm in Portland over here, and then Matt J. Howell, I think, something like that.
Yeah, and I suggested that people follow Emily on the last Follow Friday because. She's hilarious.
Yes. There's a lot of people who think that Twitter has made them a comedian. Like, there's actual comedians. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're not. Then there's like a million other people who have joke accounts and stuff and say things that they think are funny. Some of them are. Our Emily here, a tax accountant in Portland, is actually one of the consistently
genuinely funny.
Doesn't repeat herself. Yes.
She takes a 140 character format. And pretty much hits it out of the park every time, as far as I'm concerned.
Wow.
You kill me.
Wow.
You crack me up.
That is very nice of you to say. Thank you.
I love reading your tweets.
Wow. Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely one of my favorite accounts when I was on there.
Really? That really surprises me, so thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Plug.
I don't follow Friday easily, okay? I don't want you to think that's just some kind of thing that...
I was flattered by that. I don't think I've ever seen you follow Friday.
No, I don't.
Wow.
So
I'm blushing right now. You guys are too nice to me. Thank you.
You deserve it. So thank you so much for joining us today. It was awesome to have a guest.
Thank you for inviting me. This is my first endeavor into this. I'm very excited.
Well, hopefully you'll be willing
to
do it
again. She listens to thousands of book podcasts, but you're the best.
You're my favorite.
Throwing down the gauntlet right now, people. You are.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah.
That's right.
You're number one.
And by the way, we'd always love an iTunes review. If anybody wants to go to iTunes and review us, it could even be a bad review. I don't care. Just say something about us on iTunes. We'd love that.
Kind of care.
I don't care.
I mean, you can do it.
No, I'm looking for love in all the wrong places. I'll take anything.
Give some back-ended compliments at least. Or something. No.
No? I'll take it. Just give it to me. All right, folks. Well, it was great to talk to you guys. Emily, it was so nice to finally talk to you in person.
I agree. It's nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Now go get that injury taken care of that the ambulance was coming for. Take care of yourself.
I'm bleeding out right now.
Seeing you around the internet.
I appreciate you sticking with us.
All right. I'm happy to.
Good night, everybody.
Have a good night. Right.
Bye, guys.
Apartment. You sold your furniture, so we kissed on the carpet. Like a whaling ship is being on tour, you know. Next day, you got us at sail in your 354. But you were my Fiji. Oh.